Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. You know, horticulture and garden design are always evolving. And today we'll take a look at some new trends and talk about resilient gardens with our guest today. Great to have back Ben Fuda. He directs the Allen Centennial Garden right here on the UW-Madison campus. And it's always fun to have Ben come by. The fourth annual Spring Symposium is taking place at the garden on the weekend, on this weekend. We'll talk to Ben about some of the topics that are going to be covered. And, of course, we'll take your gardening questions as well. So I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to have you. And Ben, welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be back.
Well, the theme of this year's symposium is, and by the way, what's the who's involved in the symposium?
Sure. The Allen Centennial Garden here at UW has been hosting this event for, this will be our fourth year. And each year we try and bring in, you know, speakers both nationally and internationally, sort of that are around different themes within cutting edge horticulture design, things like that. And so this, and we also have some local panelists as well joining us. So from right here in Madison, some folks that are doing some good work in developing and advancing resilient landscapes as well.
And as we think about resilient landscapes, what do you mean by a resilient landscape?
Sure. So I think the best way to think of this is, you know, probably 5 or 10 years ago, and you mentioned in my intro, again, I have sort of a background in sustainability from my undergrad.
Yeah.
And, you know, 10 years ago, sustainability was the buzzword, and it certainly still is to some degree. But I think many of the conversations I'm hearing and seeing are moving to more a conversation of resilience. So sustainability implies sort of just a steady straight line, versus resilience is defined by being adaptive and being flexible to pressures. And so, you know, I mean, this spring, even we're looking at, you know, potential for record flooding, you know, in Wisconsin again. You know, how can our gardens respond to that? How do we plant differently? How do we think differently? And what can we learn from other areas of the country and some of the leading design minds in the world in terms of how to garden and grow differently?
So, what does it mean for the average gardener?
For the average gardener, I think it means looking for plants that are highly adaptable. And I'm sort of, for being a gardener, I like to say I actually have a killer instinct to some degree. So if a plant isn't cutting it, it comes out. And what I mean by that is, you know, I really look for plants that are adaptable to a range of conditions. So, you know, one day they may be tolerant of some standing water, but they could also tolerate drying out for a while. Looking for things that are disease resistant, looking for things that promote and sustain and invite sort of beneficial wildlife to support the broader garden in general. So, and of course, plants that just perform well and look good, things we're always thinking about.
Yeah. What are you, anything new in the Allen Centennial Garden that goes along those lines?
Yes. So actually this whole year we're celebrating sort of this idea of resiliency, and it's also tied into the garden itself as a resilient space. We are 30 years old this year, believe it or not. 2019 is our 30th birthday, and
cool.
So we're celebrating this resiliency birthday theme all year. So we'll have a number of sort of events happening throughout the year that are both within our community and the garden itself that look at resilient landscapes, everything from wildlife to planting design. And then also our 30th birthday as well on June 28th. That's a Friday, and all are invited. So it's an open house, and we hope to see as many folks there as we can.
That should be a lot of fun.
It should be,
I spent a lot of time in the gardens, strolling through the gardens, and they're all times of the year, they're always fun to visit.
And things are already moving. In just the last week, we've been clearing stuff out. The bulbs are coming up. The snowdrops are up. The aconite are up. So they're not wasting any time.
Ben Fuda, our guest from the Allen Centennial Garden. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Rick in Milwaukee has a question for you, Ben. Let's go there. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
I have a stand of evergreens in my backyard. There's an Austrian pine, a Colorado spruce, an Alberta spruce, and maybe some other kind of spruce. I'm not sure what it is. And I would like to make an edge border near it and put in some hosta and maybe some bulbs and mulch the whole thing. And I was wondering, how close to those trees could I rototill without getting into trouble?
Oh, and when you say close, How close were you thinking of putting that edge to the trees?
Well, certainly not under the drip line or anything like that, but I don't know, 8 feet away.
Yeah, I think, the drip line is definitely the most critical zone, but of course there's still a lot of feeder roots that will even extend beyond that. Off the top of my head, I think it would be safe to go out at least 10 feet probably from the drip line, if not even a little more. Another thing you can sort of do is dig a couple of test holes, maybe if you're doing sort of a long border, just sort of gently go in with, you know, a trowel or a hand tool or something and sort of probe around a little bit around the line at which you want to have your border. If you're encountering, you know, any roots that are sort of larger than a marker or anything like that, in terms of a marker with like a Sharpie marker, I'd probably step out a little bit further because, separating or severing too many of those can have an impact on the tree.
Yeah, there'd be another way rather than doing the rototilling too. You probably could, if you could.
Yeah, the tilling may not even be that necessary unless it's incredibly compact soil or you're going to be sort of incorporating some amendments in any way. But, I mean, typically, especially with hosta, you can sort of plant them in concrete and they'll be okay.
So, yeah. So I would, rather than rototill the whole thing, if you're doing spots, probably a little better off. Rick, does that help?
Yeah, that helps. I'll probably go out about 12 feet, but I was thinking of also incorporating some kind of an edge, either stone or concrete or plastic edging to separate the lawn from the border. And I kind of have to dig a line to do that.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't use plastic, I don't think.
Yeah, the plastic can bow up and degrade and weird. The best edging we found in the Allen Centennial Garden, at least, is a metal edging that can sort of be sort of hammered into place and then anchored with just sort of these little they come in sort of different phases or looks, but basically these sort of metal staples in a way. So there's a few different options out there for you.
All right, Rick, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. One of your speakers comes from the Millennium Park in Chicago, does?
Yes, yes. So both Scott Stewart and Austin are going to be with us for our event. And Scott is the director of the Millennium Park Foundation. And so he is sort of responsible for the fundraising and big project side of the park. And Austin has been doing some incredible work working with Scott to really look at the park as a whole in terms of its level of horticulture and display. And so Scott formerly was the director of the Lurie Garden, which is sort of a horticultural hotspot within Millennium Park itself. But now they're sort of bringing, you know, the lessons of Lurie, the aesthetic of Lurie, to the park as a whole. So rather than just sort of, you know, foundation shrubs and simple trees, they're really sort of upgrading the robust plantings and making them really interesting. So we're going to hear about that.
Yeah, that should be interesting. So how big a garden is that? Do you know?
Lurie within the park is just over 2 acres. The park itself, I don't know its full size offhand. But
it's pretty big.
It's, yes, pretty big. It's several city blocks. So
several city blocks. Yeah. Oh, my.
I'm trying to think, about one deep and two or three wide, I think, approximately. So as Millennium Park as a whole.
Wow. That is an enormous park for sure. Well, I'm going to be talking about Millennial Park. The one park that I wanted you to talk about as well was the High Line in New York. Describe that.
Yeah, so the High Line is a really incredible sort of reuse project, essentially, or a really innovative way to reuse some of our industrial infrastructure. And so several years ago, the High Line is essentially an elevated freight line that runs through the heart of New York City. And so it had been in use. It was built initially to sort of lift freight traffic off of the streets because people were getting killed and run over by, you know, freight trains and cars and other things. And so they lifted all of that up and off the street. And then it was in use through, I believe, maybe the late 60s. And then it was essentially derelict until the early 90s when the city said, well, maybe we should start thinking about taking this out. It's really an eyesore. And a group came together and said, actually, wait, there's a huge potential here for public space, especially public green space that is at such a premium in a city. And so they, you know, embarked on this amazing campaign to sort of rejuvenate and replant the space. And now it's a couple mile long linear park that runs through sort of a green ribbon that runs through New York City. Really is a testament to resilient plantings because, you know, from you know, one section of the High Line to another, it may be between buildings where there's a lot of shade or wind issues or, you know, water challenges with whether it can get rain or not. And so the plantsman, Pete Udolph, who did the planting design, really actually looked at what was growing on the High Line before they even rebuilt it to sort of take inspiration for what would grow thereafter.
So sounds like an amazing thing. Nancy from Stevens Point has another question about trees, actually. When you're thinking about resiliency, what trees should you be thinking about?
So we like to sort of point folks in the direction of choosing as many native selections as we can for trees. They typically have, of course, better disease and pest resistance, but at the same time, they also play host to a much broader range of really beneficial insects, not just pollinators, but insects of all sizes and types, wildlife as well. And they also, you know, of course, without knowing specific site conditions, you know, it, depending on your site, you know, choosing a tree accordingly, but generally going with some of those native selections because they really can sort of beef up the greater ecology around your garden and around your landscape.
Yeah. So examples of natives then?
Sure. So one of my personal favorites, sort of a small stature tree, is a serviceberry. Mm-hmm. Serviceberries are very early spring bloomer, typically multi-stem growth habit, really smooth, almost muscle-looking, sort of a silvery gray bark. It looks beautiful when it's wet, but they will actually start blooming here in just a week or two. They're a really, really early bloomer, beautiful clusters of white flowers. They then put on these, again, beautiful purple berries that, if you're lucky enough to beat the birds to them, are really delicious. But also they're a great food source for birds as well. And then their fall color is just tremendous. So, you know, or sort of a cluster of oranges and yellows and reds in their fall color.
Do they need pretty full sun, or do they?
They are actually typically seen as an understory tree, but they are adaptable to more full sun conditions. But they can do well in sort of an you know, woodland edge or underneath a more mature tree.
So that's one example, Nancy, and we'll give you perhaps some other examples. But first, I want to remind you our guest today is Ben Fuda. He's executive director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Questions for him, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you can talk about some of the unusual gardens you might have seen or trends that you see in landscaping. What landscaping questions do you have? Give a call or shoot us an email. Tyler Ditter, our engineer today, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Ben Fuda of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Taking your questions at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. You mentioned before we go back to the phones here, well, wait a minute. We've got some open line, some callers waiting, so let's just go to the phones. Tom and Madison, let's give you a chance. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you guys? Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you as well. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I got an area. It's a back corner of my yard, and there's a pine tree with branches that will overshade it. It probably gets about 50% of the day in sun. It's got a bunch of weeds and stuff that are growing in it now, and some phlox and so forth. And what I want to do is put together a nice garden that will attract hummingbirds to my yard. What plants should I select?
So it's an interesting condition since you have that little bit of shade. But a few things that come to mind off the top of my head. The first is a type of Monarda, a type of bee balm. The Latin name is Monarda bradberryana, and I think Garden Talk will sort of follow up with posting these the full names on their website and their social media. But Monarda bradberryana is a wonderful native selection. It's a bit more compact than sort of our traditional Monardas, so it only gets maybe 18 to 20 inches tall. Beautiful fall color, sort of an iridescent burgundy purple. Again, a nice sort of pale lavender flower, totally disease resistant, but can tolerate, again, sort of more of that woodland edge condition versus most typical garden Monardas want to be in full sun. So that's a good one that's sort of right on the edge. And then if there's any bit of moisture possibly back there, cardinal flower might be another choice. So Lobelia cardinalis, and that is one, again, that prefers a little bit more moisture in the soil, but especially if you have a more shaded area, might be able to do okay. But sort of tall spikes of deep red tubular flowers that the hummingbirds will just love later in summer. And again, if they prefer that wet feet, but if you don't have the wet, if it gets really dry back there, I might stay away from those. But otherwise, I think those are two good places to start.
Two good places to start, and they will attract other beneficials too.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a start for you, Tom. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Chris in Grafton next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call, by the way. You've got a great show.
Thank you.
Real quick question. I live in a condo community that has a fair amount of pond frontage, and right now it's just got some tall grasses in it. We threw some prairie flower seeds in that did come up somewhat last year. And my question is, should we do a burn to take care of the tall grasses in the spring, or should we just do a bush hog and cut them down that way and let things grow back up for the spring into the summer?
So I think your biggest concern, so did you say you were in a subdivision or suburb in any way?
Well, we're in a small condo community.
Okay.
But the pond frontage is all ours.
Okay. Yeah, the only thing I would recommend to check with is, of course, sort of if there are any local covenants or county state regulations on burning, especially if it's in a slightly more developed area. But once, if you've ruled that out, for burning spaces, typically right now, yeah, definitely would be the time to do it now within the next week or so. I wouldn't wait too much longer. Typically an every other year burn would be sufficient to sort of encourage, the prairie ecosystem that we want. If this is your first burn, that's great, but again, don't feel like you need to do this, every season, certainly. But again, every other year is sort of a good, barometer. But again, if your town has any, you know, or development has any limitations on burning, a brush hog also certainly does the work. The biggest thing is to sort of keep down, you know, any woody selections or species that may be sort of moving in to keep it more prairie-like.
Yeah, that's for sure. So you need to check that out. And sometimes local ordinances, they may even have some fire personnel
mm-hmm.
handy to help out with it or to sort of direct it. So that's certainly worth looking at.
Yep, absolutely.
Thank you, Chris. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Well, you can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Tammy in Madison next. Hi, Tammy.
Hi. I have an apple tree. It's about 6 years old in my front yard. And actually my neighbors also have a couple of apple trees in their front yard, and we've sustained some rabbit damage on the trunk and on the lower branches because the snow kind of got up high, which this is something that has never happened to either of us at any time before in the like 6 or so years we've had these trees. And so probably a 15... inch wide trunk or circumference around the trunk, and they haven't gone all the way around, but probably a pretty good patch of, I'd say like 6 or 7 inches by 10 or 12 inches going up the side.
Was it under the snow line?
No, it was. They were standing on top of the snow, and they did it right on top of the snow.
Yeah, sometimes if it was under the snow, it might have been something else, like voles.
Yeah, I will say, Tammy, you are not alone this
year.
We, in the Allen Centennial Garden, we had some rabbit damage hitting things that we've never had hit before, again, with... So you are not alone is my first word of comfort. Second, I guess, if are you just sort of wondering sort of next steps to take or things to look out for, anything like that?
I think both. Okay. Yeah. If there is a step to take, it's protected now, and they haven't gotten any more damage. I did trim some branches off, and they've been munching on the branches that are off, which is nice. So they've left the live tree alone, but yeah, anything you can do to help.
Sure. So I think it's a good news, bad news scenario. Good news is they did not. So you were saying they didn't eat away all around the trunk, and so it sounds like, you know, that layer of bark is really where the lifeblood of the tree sort of resides from year to year. And so if they didn't scalp it all away, then the tree will not necessarily die. But don't be surprised this spring if you know, it may bud out or bloom initially, and then it might show a lot of stress. Because it just isn't able to, you know, sort of move the water and nutrients up and down the trunk as it normally would. So keep an eye on it may not be a bad idea to, and I'm not, Larry, if you know more, sound in, if there should be any sort of pruning to sort of reduce stress in the spring right now.
I don't know that I'd worry too much about that, right? Okay. Unless the branches are crisscrossing or whatever.
Okay.
I wouldn't, you know, more leaves might be better.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, keep an eye on things as it leafs out. Just know that it might be under stress this year. It may not. If it does flower and start to produce fruit, I actually would pick off those small apples when you first see them start to form. Forgo the harvest this year so the tree can put more energy into rebuilding, whether it's roots, healing the bark, anything like that. Just don't tax it with trying to produce fruit this year. And then a couple other thoughts. One would be for going into next winter, there are some tree bark wraps that you can get that are sort of just these they look like crepe paper almost, but most garden centers will have them sort of wrapping the base of the tree trunk in November and then unwrapping it early in spring will help to prevent sort of this nibbling from happening in the future. And final thing, you know, don't put any, you know, tar or any substance over that wound. Leave it open to the air. The tree will begin to heal it, but it will take some time.
And I was thinking back a week or two ago, we had someone send us a photo of a beautiful, it was sent two photos, one of a beautiful flowering crab in the summer, spring, and then a winter shot where it had been completely 10 inches high and all the way around, and there's no hope for that one.
Yeah, if they've gone all the way around the trunk, there's unfortunately no hope if they've girdled it. But as long as there's still some bark from the root flare to the upper canopy, if there's some of it that they haven't touched, then the tree should survive. Just know it might have a year or two of recovery ahead of it.
And Tammy, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We got a lot of tree questions here lately.
Yeah,
we can take other plant questions as well for sure.
Yes.
At 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to Eric and Spooner next. Hi, Eric.
Hi. It doesn't have to be tree, but thanks. We have a cabin up in Burnett County, very sandy soil that had an extreme weather event, rainfall a couple years ago. Water table went up, a lot of standing water, and a bunch of the white pine and red pine died. So now I got a big backyard that, for the most part, very dry, but is prone to these heavy rains and stuff. So I'm trying to decide what to plant there. Any suggestions?
So you've got here we go with the resilience.
This is a really good one. Yeah. One thing, a couple that come to mind. One is a pin oak is one. If you're looking for trees, pin oak might be one option. Again, they can tolerate either, you know, some of that occasional moisture, but they're also fairly tap rooted, and so they can go through some drier conditions as well, and sort of again bounce back in between things pretty easily. A second idea, and this is the one I'm a little more uncertain of. I might do a little bit more research, but bald cypress. Typically, you can find them growing like directly in swamps. I mean, they can tolerate that level of moisture, but I've also seen them in some drier areas that just occasionally will flood. And, you know, they won't, if they're in a really wet spot, they'll put up those cypress knees like you would see in a bog or a swamp. But in a drier space, they won't put up those knees. But again, they're fairly adaptable trees that you know, especially if you've got areas that could hold water potentially frequently, those could be good choices.
What about, you mentioned earlier to an earlier caller, serviceberry. Will serviceberry take a sandier soil like that?
It probably will. I don't know if it'll take the, if there's standing water. I don't know if it'll take the water, but it probably can handle this, the sandier soil.
All right. So there's a couple ideas. Does that help, Eric?
Yeah, it does. Thanks. And there's a little bit of a incline in our backyard. So maybe like if I planted the serviceberries a little bit higher than the lowest spot, maybe something like that would work.
Yeah.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, that for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Jeanette in Hudson, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Actually, I'm in Baldwin, close to Hudson. I have a cherry tree that's good to 30 below. I lost my cherry tree that I had last year with the April storm. We planted it last July to make sure that there was a good root system put in place. And at the end of December, double wrapped it in burlap and made sure that was around the tree up until this time. I have not removed the burlap. When would be a good time to remove the burlap for that cherry tree?
And the snow's all gone, right?
No, we still have some snow, but it's 50 degrees today.
Okay.
I would say I think you're probably in the clear at this point. You know, again, we certainly may still have a frost, and who knows? There certainly could still be a snowstorm after this point. We hope not. But just in terms of sort of, you know, I would doubt that we're going to see those negative 20, 30-degree temperatures at this point. And as the tree starts to come out of dormancy, having good airflow, you know, access to pollinators will be important. So I think you're probably good to take it off.
Yeah. There you go, Jeanette. Thank you. Dennis in De Pere, we go to you next. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I was just calling in regards to the caller with the tree that got girdled by rabbits. And I know we've done grafting before. I have not been successful with the bridge grafting, as our trees typically have gotten hit by the voles when I haven't protected them. They go down to the ground. But I was wondering about the option of bridge grafting for them since they have bark, exposed bark above and below the ground.
Yeah, what do you think?
I've certainly know of the technique. I've never done it personally, but you know, I think the concept is essentially, you know, if you have solid good bark, maybe, you know, 10-12 inches above the soil surface where the rabbits didn't eat, you could hypothetically cut your losses or be a little bold and take off the top of the tree and regraft to the rootstock that's in the ground. Again, that is far outside of my personal realm of expertise, so I would consult other sources if that's something you're interested in doing, but it certainly is a possibility.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Dennis. And Ron in Wallace, your turn. Hi, Ron.
Good morning. Interesting show.
Thank you.
I have a mature maple tree. It's about 60 feet high. I think it's a sugar maple. I'm not sure. But right at ground level, there's a hole in the bark about the size of a softball that goes right to the interior of the tree. Now, I don't know that much about trees, but I heard that the nutrients for the feeding the leaves, the upper branches, goes through the bark. Is that correct?
It is, yeah.
Well, how much can you destroy that bark at the base before you start losing your leaves started dying and the tree starts dying?
So I want to say it probably depends on the tree in question more times than not. And if this is in your case with an older tree, you know, some of them, especially as they get larger, can sort of develop these dead areas or sort of dead zones in the middle near the base. It's not terribly uncommon, but it probably would indicate that, you know, that also then does open up the center of the tree to all, you know, insects, other things that over time may weaken the center of the tree. You know, to really know for a great diagnosis, you know, contacting a local arborist to come out and take a look if you're really concerned. Softball size doesn't seem too dire, right? I mean,
no.
I've seen some trees that are just you could fit a person in it. So, you know, I don't know that you're at the risk of any structural damage at this point. But in terms of knowing if this tree is under stress, a couple things to look out for could be, does it turn fall color earlier than other maple trees in your area or neighborhood? If it's starting to color up and lose its leaves a week, 2-4 weeks in advance, then you know it's feeling some stress from something. That's one thing to check.
Yeah, for sure. But I would, yeah, I guess maybe an arborist, certified arborist, mm-hmm. To take a look at it. But with a tree of that age and that size hole, I'd...
Yeah, if you could park a car into it, I'd be worried. But that size hole, I think you're probably safe for a while.
Thank you, Ron. Appreciate it. Caitlin in Stevens Point emailed. She'd like to hear some more about some larger 3 to 4 foot bushes, plants that are hardy, don't need a lot of maintenance, and would work in morning sun, eastern facing, mostly shade. So,
oh, these are all good questions. there, let's see. Oh, I can tell it's coming after winter because I'm blanking on all my plant names. Haven't been outside enough. I'll give this some thought, and then if I come up with anything during the break, we'll post it on the Facebook page. If
yeah,
that works.
Or we can talk about it online on air as well. Tammy and Nina, let's go to you. Hi, Tammy.
Hi there.
What's on your mind today?
I have a question, an opposite question of growing a tree or helping a tree.
Okay.
I have a tree that's growing between the foundation and the sidewalk. We recently purchased some property, and when we trim it down, it's great, but it continues to grow back. And I was just wondering how to get rid of that without digging up the side. I think it's the sugar maple. I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure it's a sugar maple.
So you say you've been cutting it down before?
Trimming the branches, you know, down to the base, down to the trunk. It's just made itself conveniently growing between the foundation and the sidewalk. Yeah. And I don't know, without digging up like the sidewalk, or I guess I don't know how to get rid of it. It continues to grow because we keep chopping it, you know,
I mean,
as low as we can. But
so you're taking it right off at the base, the main trunk of the tree, you're cutting it off?
Most of it, yep. As far as we can go, yes.
And then it starts little side branches coming up?
Mm-hmm, yep. So yeah. Maybe it's not a sugar maple. Maybe it's whatever is my tree. My neighbor has a tree that has branches that come out by the roots as well. But it just continues to keep growing or coming back. And I was wondering if you had an easy fix without using chemicals to get rid of it.
Part of it, what time of year are you cutting it back?
Usually later summer when it gets big enough.
Okay.
When it's more noticeable.
Okay. Because
I'd cut it off right now.
Well, and you could do it. Hypothetically. And the other thing that could determine whether it resprouts or not is the height at which you're cutting it from the ground. So if you're cutting it, you know, within, again, you know, depending on the size of the tree and the age of the tree, this could be a factor. But if you're cutting it fairly close to the ground level, that might encourage it to do this sort of suckering behavior. If you, in winter, again, right now, the tree's probably starting to come out of dormancy. But if you maybe cut like a foot above ground or so, between 1 and 2 feet, sometimes that'll just sort of stall it out. But if it's a maple and it's been doing this for a couple of years, you know, aside from either digging it if it's not too large or getting in a stump grinder, those would be the sort of two non-chemical options I can think of.
Yeah, the stump grinder would be a non-chemical. The other would be to cut it off and cover it with black plastic.
Yep, you could also cut it back and just smother it for a year, or a tarp or something. Yep.
Yeah, I that might be, if you're looking for a non-chemical way, that might be...
Mm-hmm.
A little longer term than a stump grinder, but you may not be able to get a grinder in there between the house and the sidewalk. So if you whack it down to the bottom and then put some black plastic over it, that black plastic is going to help too.
Yep, absolutely.
That's probably your best bet, Tammy. I hope that helps.
Okay, well, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Let's take Martha next in Racine. Hi, Martha.
Hello. I have a tidbit I'd like to mention. This I didn't mention to the producer, but when we wanted to get rid of a stump in a really warm climate when we lived in Texas, we'd drill holes in the stump and then pour Coca-Cola. What do you think of that? Was it just attracted bugs and things to come and eat the Coca-Cola, I think, and presumably eat the...
Martha, I haven't heard that one before.
I've heard of the drilling holes in to sort of allow, you know, microbes and insects to get in faster to decompose a stump, but the coke trick is new. I've never heard that one before.
No. Anyway, you didn't call just for that. What else did you have in mind?
My original question was, I had a row of arborvitae, I believe they were arborvitae. It's in along a kind of an ugly fence, and it's in building shade, so it only gets afternoon western sun. They all died during the drought a couple of years ago, and I would like a recommendation on a shrub that would be happy in it with that little sun.
So how many?
I'd really like it to grow to be like, you know, 8 feet tall eventually.
So one choice may be the service berry that we talked about earlier. That's one that, again, could probably tolerate some lower light conditions, again, as it's typically an understory tree. A small stature tree. So typically they'll top out in sort of that 8 to 12 foot range, give or take. That's sort of one that comes to mind. Are you looking for something that has a similar form to the shrubs you lost, or just anything that sort of hits that 8 to 10 foot mark?
Correct. Anything that hits that. But I do happen to like serviceberry. They're the ones that keep their berries all winter, right, until the birds eat them?
The serviceberry berries will typically be ripe in June, July time-ish, just about, and they typically don't last too long. The birds do really enjoy them, but they will typically eat. They don't persist into winter too much. Some other thoughts might be looking into some viburnum. There's several viburnum cultivars out there that do have, can tolerate a little bit of shade, and also can it will probably give you the height you're looking for.
All right. There you go, Martha. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's take Donald in Bayfield County. Hi, Donald.
Hello. What are the signs of oak wilt has set into a tree, and do they sooner or later die? How long does it take for the kill them?
So oak wilt, typically you'll start to see the leaves on the top.
Mm-hmm.
Of the tree, right, Ben?
I believe, yeah. So from top down, they'll either be falling off, or they just won't leaf out in the spring, or your tip or more tip branches will start to die off. Yeah.
So it starts there, and sometimes it can go pretty fast. I mean, you could lose the leaves off a tree in a few weeks,
mm-hmm.
and the tree could be gone in that quick. Do you have a situation in Bayfield County?
Yeah. I had a tree, a windstorm came down and took off half of my oak tree.
Which means that the insects could have gotten in there with the disease.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you want to keep an eye on it. Are there other oaks in the yard?
Several.
Oh. If I were you with several oaks, I would get a certified arborist to come out and take a look at the tree, because an arborist would be able to tell you. And you don't want it spreading via the roots to other trees if it does have oak wilt disease. And there are things that can be done to cut any root grafts from one oak tree to the next. And I wouldn't wait. I'd get out there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get an arborist out there pretty quickly, because you want to know, because if there are a lot of other oaks on your property, you could well lose them all.
Mm-hmm.
If you get just one tree with oak wilt. Donald, good luck. Get a hold of us, and I would emphasize certified.
Yes.
Arborist. A certified arborist is someone who is trained, has more training, and has kind of a code of ethics that they follow and so forth, and would be more likely to be able to give you a correct diagnosis. And if you put certified applied arborists in the...
And there's, I think, the Wisconsin Arborists Association Yeah,
the Wisconsin Arborist Association, that's the name of the group I was trying to think of, would be able to give you names of certified arborists in Bayfield County.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Good luck. Thank you so much. And let's see. We are going to John in Mount Horeb. Hi, John.
Yes, hi, thank you. I have a question about how best to transplant, transplant a very small bur oak tree or trees. We have a number of bur oaks on our property, but next to the woods, and I'd like to transplant one or two of them up closer to the house, but I'm not sure of the best time of the year or the optimum size and so on. So any suggestions you might have?
How tall are they?
Well, I can choose. I have them all different sizes because we have quite a bit of wood. So I can choose whatever you think might be the optimum size.
With an oak, smaller would be better.
Smaller is better, yep.
In fact, I'd go with the smallest one I could find because of the roots.
Yeah, anything around like the 3 to 5 foot range probably, you know, more than a little sapling, but anything more than that, so you know where it is. But yeah, smaller would be better, I would say, and also make the transplant process easier, less stress on the tree itself. In terms of time of year, if you could do it in spring, but just know that it might, again, keep it well watered for the first year or two. Keep an eye on it. But the ideal time would actually probably be fall. So October, November, as the trees are going dormant, they're not being moved and then being asked to put on leaves for the year. They're sort of, you know, just shutting down for the season. So unless you really want to get going this year, I would say fall would be your optimal time.
John, thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Larry Mealer here with my guest, Ben Fuda, Executive Director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Taking your plant questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. We're here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mealer, talking plants today with our guest, Ben Fuda, Executive Director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Question about some plants in your area, what you'd like to, maybe a question about what to plant, maybe some ideas about different species. Love to hear from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And before we get to Judy in Watertown, I wanted to mention Mike in Lake Mills called to recommend for standing water areas a button bush. Mm-hmm. What do you think? You like it?
Yeah, I think that'd be a great choice. Also, this reminded me of spice bush. Could be another one that actually can tolerate quite a bit of standing water in moist conditions.
And those are natives, both natives.
They are, yes.
Both are natives. I know wildlife like it. So button bush is a good one. And again, the
spice bush.
Mm-hmm. Judy in Watertown, thank you so much for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I have a problem living on the riverbank on the Rock River in Watertown, and I want to clean up a lot of poison ivy and oak that I found out the hard way that was there. So what would be a safe way to control what's on the beautiful rocks underneath, but it's been so overtaken by, well, poison ivy and other little things. And I don't want to hurt the river, but how should I do that?
So you have, and it's growing amidst, you have rocks that are sort of protecting the banks, and it's growing between the rocks?
Correct.
All right.
This is a pickle. Especially being on the water, I mean, you know, using any kind of chemicals would be something ideally to stay away from. I mean, my next best guess would just be to grab some hazmat gear and dive in and pull manually. I mean, it will pull if you're working with any canes that are, 2-3 inches across, you'll just have to, those I would actually say you probably will need to cut and treat the stems with an herbicide. But if it's just small, you know, pencil sized stems or smaller, it certainly can be pulled. I also would probably try and do it now before the leaves are on. It'll just make your life and your job probably a little easier. But, wear long sleeves, long pants, gloves, even some level of facial protection wouldn't hurt. And then just be very cautious when sort of taking off those clothes when you get back in the house and just put them straight in the washer. If you do come into contact with any poison ivy and you know you hit it, cold water within 15 minutes of contact is a great way. It'll close your pores sort of before the oils can really enter your body. So run it under cold water, what, you know, finger, arm, leg, whatever, until your skin is more or less numb. It'll close those pores and then just sort of wash it off with soap and water. And that can help to mitigate any of the reaction should you be exposed.
Judy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Holly in Two Rivers, it's your turn. Hi, Holly.
Hi. We have something I believe is called horsetail. It's a round tubular body. They grow maybe 2 to 3 feet tall, depending on. And they have a fruiting body that has spores all over it. And they are so thick, and I can't get rid of them by cutting them down. What do you suggest?
They're growing right in the pond?
No, next to, right next to the pond.
So you're. It sounds like you're dealing with horsetail. The Latin name for these guys is Equisetum. So this is a prehistoric plant. It's been around for a long time. But the roots of this one in particular aren't terribly deep. It can be dug. It might take a few rounds to get all of it. If there's any, you know, little bits of the root that's left, it could potentially come back. But it can be manually removed if you really want it out. But I will also just add, it is, again, it is sort of native to the area. It's not necessarily a bad thing to have. So unless, you know, it don't feel like you have to take it out.
All right. There you go. Holly, I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Caitlin in Stevens Point emailed that she'd like to hear about some of the larger bushes or plants that are hardy, don't need a ton of maintenance, but would work in morning sun, mostly shade, 3 to 4 footers.
It's the don't need a ton of maintenance part that is catching me. I mean, offhand, you know, for this size, certainly I think hydrangeas could be a good selection. Some of the woodier hydrangeas, things like either the hydrangea arborescens or the hydrangea limelight is a little bit more compact one that tops out. With proper pruning, can sort of be kept in that 3 to 4 foot range-ish. The arborescens hydrangea, again, is just about perfect for that size as well. And again, the morning sun's actually great because afternoon sun that's too hot will make them wilt. So if it's just morning sun they're working with, that should be okay.
Paul from Cross Plains, going back to standing water here for a minute, he says he likes a swamp oak for water, you know, standing water conditions.
Yeah, and that's another one too. Really beautiful tree, but again, is also nice because it is adaptable. It can be in swampier conditions. I've also seen them growing in sandy slopes too. So it's another really nicely adaptable tree.
There's a nice one growing on the UW-Madison campus. Mm-hmm. That's just absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
It is a beautiful, beautiful tree. Well, I wanted to get back to the symposium because, for one thing, it's everything is sold out. Saturday is all sold out.
Correct. Our Saturday session, our sort of main event, is totally sold out for us this year, which is both very exciting, but also, we would love to welcome more folks, but it is sold out for sure.
Well, it's a good thing.
It's a good problem to have. It just means we'll find a bigger room next year. So,
oh yeah, you're going to have to do that. As we're visiting today with Ben Fuda, Ben is executive director of the Allen Centennial Gardens here on the UW-Madison campus. The Allen Gardens are a wonderful place to visit. Maybe you've got how many different settings?
So again, our total size were 2 acres, but within that 2 acres we have 15 to 20 different themed garden spaces throughout. We're always open, we're always free admission,
and that's amazing. It's always fun for me to go in and look, and you know, every time I go it always seems like, well, there's something
We try and switch it up for sure. Always have something new.
Something I didn't see before. How many people visit the garden every year? Any ideas?
So that is actually a big unanswered question we're working on this year. But I can tell you for our programming that we have, we see about 13,000 people a year just for programming, not including just folks walking through on their own. So my guess would be far more than that number.
I would think that it would be 3-4 times.
I hope so. I'll take bets.
I can hardly walk by without seeing somebody walking.
Absolutely.
Walking through those gardens. Well, Ben Fuda, our guest, as I said, it's always fun to visit with him on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to Garden Talk. Thank you so much for listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest, Ben Fuda, today, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. And at the garden this weekend, as a matter of fact, tonight and tomorrow, the symposium is going on. Actually, the symposium itself goes on all day tomorrow. That is sold out, unfortunately, so you're not going to be able to make it to that. But there's a film screening tonight, and it relates to, I believe, the symposium itself. So, Ben, you want to mention that and talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're showing the film Five Seasons, The Gardens of Piet Udolf tonight. And so this is a documentary film about Piet Udolf. He's a Dutch plantsman and garden designer. Some of his commissions include the High Line in New York, Lurie Garden in Millennium Park. And so those are a couple of our speakers on Saturday. But the film really profiles Pete, his life, his approach to design, and sort of this will actually be my first time seeing it, but what I hear is that it's very artful, moving, and we do still have lots of seats available for that. And so that's happening tonight, Friday night, at Union South here on campus in the Marquee Theater, and tickets are $10 at the door.
So, and that's an hour film? Or
About an hour and a half, I believe.
About a 90-minute film on Piet Udolf. Well, I'm sure within the film itself, there'll be some shots of the gardens.
Absolutely.
A lot of shots of the gardens. And it'd be worth it just to see. And he did Highline, right?
Yes, he did. Yep, the Highline, yep.
Be worth it just to see the Highline. So that's tonight again. What's the time?
The showtime is 3:30 this afternoon. Doors will open at 3 p.m.
Okay. And is it another second showing or just that
just,
one?
Just the one. So you've got about 3 hours to get to campus if you want to be here. So.
All right. 3:30, Union South. We had Veronica emailing to ask for suggestions for resilient gardens to see in Wisconsin.
This is a great question. So the public garden nerd in me loves this. So, of course, I'll have to start with our wonderful gardens in Madison. So the Allen Centennial Garden, of course, but also Ulbrich and the Arboretum here. Both of them, all three of us really, sort of speak to this topic in different yet similar ways. And so all are a great trip. But even throughout Wisconsin, any public garden, I think, worth their salt is thinking about this and doing work in this in some way. Some of the big anchors to think of would be, Green Bay Botanic Garden.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm blanking on the name of the one right outside Milwaukee, Borner Botanical Garden. And then if you're in the north part of the state, across the state line into Minnesota, the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum is a tremendous place to visit as well.
And if we're missing one in your area, call and
let us know. I know there's
more
out there. There's a lot more out
there.
There,
give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear about those other gardens. But also, if you have a question about a plant, join in. Again, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Liz in La Crosse emailed a question about blueberries and raspberries. She planted them a couple years ago. Is it best to prune them? And if so, what time of year? Also wondering if you have non-chemical ways to keep deer and weeds away.
Yeah, so for the raspberries, I'll start with that one. It depends on the variety that you have. So there's some that are will bear fruit earlier in the season, and so they will flower and fruit on last year's growth. Others are late summer bearing, and so those typically will do better if they're cut to the ground each year, and they'll fruit more heavily. So just doing a little bit of research into the specific variety that you have will sort of give some information for that. And in terms of the blueberries, again, you could certainly do a little minor pruning now, but bearing in mind that, again, they will flower on the wood that's there and fruit on that wood as well. So I wouldn't take off too much. The only pruning I would do is if you see any damage or, you know, any crossing branches that are a real issue, but I would try to leave most things intact and sort of do a more shaping prune late summer after harvest.
And with the blueberries, you're going to want to be watching the soil itself mm-hmm, as mm-hmm. well, because you want a more acid soil.
Correct, more acid soil. Yep, absolutely.
So a regular soil testing probably every few years, a couple of years, is probably be
absolutely.
Useful.
Absolutely.
All right. In terms of non-chemical ways to keep deer and weeds away, that deer and weeds are kind of different. On the deer,
but physical barriers would be my sort of first thought. So they make bird netting is essentially, which again would also work for birds as well. But it's sort of a really fine netting that is a physical barrier that prevents things from getting right up on top of those plants and sort of doing too much damage. So if you, you know, I wish most of us could afford to put a 6-foot tall fence around our gardens for deer, but the bird netting is a fairly inexpensive, easy way to sort of go about putting that physical barrier in place. And then for weeds, especially in sort of a productive area, you know, the area like the around blueberries or raspberries, one thing I might actually suggest is looking at certain ground covers, things like clovers maybe, or things that really don't get much more than 8 to 10 inches tall, so they won't compete with the berries you're growing. But rather than introducing mulch every year, these will sort of be a green mulch that also fixes nitrogen at the same time and provides flowers and nectar for pollinators.
So. Yeah, it's a very good suggestion for sure. Well, we have Stephen Harrison who has a question for you. Let's go there. Hi, Steve.
Hi. This is for me. I have a tree question.
Okay.
Is there a formula or anything to tell how old a tree would be? Like an old oak tree. Like the height, circumference?
There probably is. Off the top of my head, I don't know what it would be. Larry, do you have any ideas?
There's an arborist. He's retired now, pretty much. Bruce Allison is an arborist who can do a pretty good job. There are actually ways to X-ray the tree. I think you can get some information about the age of a tree from that. There's also, I think there's more generally, you can take a look at the circumference of the tree and the height of the tree and you can get some idea as to the approximation of the age of the tree. But other than that, I don't know of another way you could do it. So it's tough, but Bruce has written a couple of books on trees, the Champion Trees of Wisconsin, and he You might take a look at that book because there may be, you may have a comment or two about determining the age of those trees. And Bruce Allison, the Champion Trees of Wisconsin, and I don't have the book in front of me right now, but that would be a place that might have some more information on that. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate it. Kathy and Blair, and somebody's for sure going to call and say, wait a minute, you dummy, you forgot this or that. But
right.
That'd be okay, too. I wouldn't mind that. I never mind that when people call in to either correct me or add additional information. Now we'll go to Kathy and Blair. Hi, Kathy.
Hello. We will be taking our guests to the Allen Centennial Garden April 22nd, and I was wondering what flowers we would expect to see during that time.
Awesome. Well, first of all, thank you for visiting. And of course, it's a perfect time in spring to come visit us. The two spaces in particular that will really be looking good will be our woodland garden, which is sort of on the north side of the house. So a lot of the spring ephemerals should be up and sort of hitting their stride by this point. And then our rock garden as well. That really is a sort of an April and May garden. A lot of the alpine plants really, really shine this time of year. Aside from those two spaces, though, of course, we'll have bulbs, tulips, daffodils. Our bulb lawn will be in bloom. So we have about 6,000 bulbs planted within our English garden lawn. So that should be on display around that time as well. And then some of our flowering trees. All of this depending on weather, but, you know, give or take, you know, magnolias, crab apples, perhaps, maybe a little early for them, but the magnolias will probably be close. So
yeah, they should be pretty close. Kathy, there you go. You're going to have a lot of fun.
It'll be a good time. Yeah.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, Ben in Stevens Point has something about aging a tree, and I think he's got a good answer. Let's go there. Hi, Ben.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. A gentleman had called in asking about the age of trees. He might have had an old oak tree, and he was wondering how to tell the age. An increment borer is really the way to go. So you can purchase those relatively cheaply online. And you basically are drilling a small hole that will likely not harm the tree, but you're drilling a hole through to the center, and then you're able to extract this, what looks like a really long straw, which is just a sample of all of the rings of the tree, which you can then count to get the, you know, almost exactly age of that tree.
And so what's it called again, Ben?
It's called an increment borer.
Increment borer. Now, I'd be careful when I did that. I think with an oak.
Yeah, that's the time of year. Yeah, the rule of thumb with oaks is you do not prune from April to June. So you wouldn't want to injure an oak tree from April to June. That's kind of the height of oak wilt spreading.
Yeah, I think it even goes longer than that. But I think it goes into the fall season. But probably would be okay yet to do it if you did it pretty quickly,
mm-hmm.
pretty quickly. Ben, thank you so much. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. As we take a look at the garden, Allen Garden, for this year, let's look back at last year first for a minute. Were there things that came up last year for you that you said, oh, we're not going to do that again, or issues on that side of
sure.
things?
there's always some things that we're tweaking and adjusting. You know, that's the life in the garden type of thing. You know, one of our big projects last year was renovating our New American Garden, which also ties into sort of our film showing tonight and our symposium. But it's this, very much inspired by designers like Pete Udolph and Roy Diblick and others like that, who plant in these huge swaths of sort of herbaceous plants. That was one really big project. That, of course, even though we simply planted it for the first year last year, there were certain things that the rabbits liked more than others that we had to rogue out and replace. But that'll be an area we're really watching to see and how things are performing. We also had some really beautiful asters along the outside of our fence and our perennial border out there. However, they were just a little too aggressive for what we had. They were overpowering some of the other perennials that we had in the space. And so we did some replacements there with some, put in some new different things. And so hopefully this year it should be it'll be another new experience.
Yeah. So the asters are... I was trying to remember. Are they normally that aggressive?
Some of them, it depends on the variety. In this case, the soil up there is fairly rich, and they had not a lot of competition. So they did what they would normally do. they looked great for 2 or 3 years. And then we said, they're just getting – and they were a little out of scale. They were about 4 feet tall. Everything else in the border is about 2 foot tall. So they were just a little out of scale. So from a design perspective, we decided to swap them out.
Andy in Madison, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Andy.
Hello, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I want to do some landscaping in the house I just purchased this past fall.
Yeah.
And there are 3 dogwood bushes and a raised bed. I want to move them out of the raised bed and use a raised bed for gardens. Can I move them this spring, or do I have to wait till fall?
And just to confirm, you said these were the shrub variety, so like a red or golden twig dogwood type of thing?
Yeah, really red.
Red osier.
Okay. Yeah, you should be able to move them now. Dogwoods, especially those, are the tree forms are a little different story, but the shrub forms are fairly durable, I will say. So you should be able to move them once the soil is thawed enough and it's not muddy anymore. Again, bearing in mind, they just keep them well watered throughout this growing season, and they might, again, not be super aggressive growers this year, but within the next 1 to 2 years, they will likely take off.
All right. Does that help, Andy?
Before I move them? I was going to say, should I do any pruning before I move them, or try to pick them up as is?
If they're really large, mature plants, if there's any canes that are larger than, again, probably like sidewalk chalk, the first thing that comes to mind in terms of diameter. If there's any really big old canes in there, those I would prune those regardless of if you were going to move, just to sort of keep stimulating fresh growth. But if they're mostly sort of young, like pencil thin or ish size things, I don't think I'd have to. I wouldn't worry too much about pruning them before you move them.
Thanks, guys.
All right, yeah, thanks absolutely. A lot for calling. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234. Give a call. Rick emailed to ask if you can prune hydrangeas right now.
The answer is yes and no. So it depends on the hydrangea. If it's things like the paniculata hydrangeas or, like those are a fairly common one. Those can be pruned now and, in fact, are better to promote summer flowering. But it's because they flower on the current year's growth. If there's any... hydrangeas we have out there, the hydrangea macrophyllas are out there. Those, first of all, are kind of a hit and miss in terms of whether they're really hardy for us, of course. But assume they came through the winter okay. Those are going to bloom on last year's growth. So if we cut those down, we would definitely not get any flowers. So just do a little research into what species you have, whether it's blooms on first or second year growth, and that'll sort of inform when you can prune.
Let's talk a bit about this whole idea of resilient landscaping. You know, as we go and we visit Allen and we visit some of the other places, how do you translate what you see into your own garden or setting?
So one thing that I would always encourage folks to do is talk to us. Of course, the gardeners, the folks who are digging in the soil in that space, observing plants is certainly one, or observing gardens is certainly one place to start. But if you see, volunteers or gardeners working, pull us aside and ask us questions. Ask similar to what you asked, what did well last year? What are you changing? Why are you changing it? Asking questions like that are really great ways to sort of learn about what's unique to the every site. But then if you're not lucky enough to sort of encounter anybody on your particular visit, I think paying, attention to plant communities, so looking at how, different gardens are combining plants together. And so, we really try and plant in ways at the Allen, we try and plant communities of plants that support each other. And so what I mean by that is, they occupy different sort of layers of the planting. We have things that are ground covers, things that are sort of popping up through that. If it's in a woodland, you have an understory and a canopy layer. So trying to look at really utilizing how these gardens utilize those different layers. And also looking at succession of bloom too, you know, the notion that, you know, trying, of course, to have something that looks good year round, but how do these gardens balance the ebb and flow of, you know, having one performer come on the stage as the others are going off, just sort of paying attention to that succession of bloom.
That is something that a trick that I have not always been successful with in my own plantings, but sometimes when it works, it's great.
Yeah, when you sync up, it's great. Yeah, absolutely.
Mick in Sawyer County, let's go to you. Hi, Mick. Thanks for calling.
Yes, I have several apple trees, and I normally prune them in January when it deep freeze, but there was so much snow that I couldn't get out there without a sled dog team. So I'm wondering if I still can prune them here in the spring. Will it harm them, or will I allow insects and things to get in there?
So the sort of rule of thumb that I've been told that we sort of work with is between Valentine's Day and Tax Day is sort of the sweet spot for fruit tree pruning. So I think if you were to do it in the next week or two, you'll probably be okay, but I wouldn't wait too much longer than that.
No, it should be. Should be doing it right
today
now.
Would be a great day, yes.
Yeah, today would be a great, or this weekend would be a great weekend for it, Mick. So get the pruning or the saws out and the pruning mm-hmm. shears and have at it. And look for those branches that are kind of crossing each other. Get rid of the one that's doing the damage and open that apple tree up a bit, and mm-hmm. you're going to have more apples when it comes to time to harvest them. Well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you is there anything new and exciting in the way of new varieties out there, new types that you're excited about?
Yeah, so one place we're following, two places actually. So the first is Mount Cuba Center, and this is a public garden on the East Coast in sort of the Delaware Valley area. And they predominantly showcase native plants, but they're doing plant trials with native plant cultivars and sort of new selections that are coming on the market. And, you know, a lot of places do plant trials, and of course they're looking for disease resistance and bloom time and all those types of factors, but Mount Cuba's taken that one step further in that they look at the ecological impact of these plants. And so, so if people are concerned about, you know, nativars or native cultivars are sort of a hot topic right now in terms of, you know, a lot of breeding work is happening with natives. But Mount Cuba is really looking at, of those, not only how do they perform on all the other characteristics, but how well do they support our local native pollinators and other wildlife? You know, how resilient are they? And so that's part of their scoring criteria. All of their plant evaluation data is available online on their website, very simple to navigate and easy to see. The other place we're sort of following that we work with quite often is a nursery just over the Wisconsin-Illinois border called Intrinsic Perennial Gardens. And so they are a wholesale nursery but also doing a lot of breeding with native selections as well, again, introducing a lot of things that are you know, either maybe a little more compact or a little more appropriate for urban settings. But again, sort of doing a little bit of cross-checking between, you know, nurseries that are doing introductions with, you know, public gardens and other institutions that are then trialing them and evaluating them. So our space, we're simply not large enough to do real plant evaluation. So we sort of look to others for that information. So
again, it's Intrinsic. And what was the first you
mentioned? Mount Cuba Center.
Yep. So you can go online,
yep,
find either one of those for that information. Well, Ben, it's a pleasure. Once again, we're out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. And that film is this afternoon at 3:30?
3:30 is showtime, yes.
At Union South.
At Union South here in Madison, yep.
Ben Fuda is executive director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. Their big symposium this weekend. It's all sold out for Saturday, but you could still, if you got time... Can still get in there this afternoon for that film. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.